Film Spotting is brought to you by the new PeerFlix.com, a fun place to get movies for less.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. On this week's show, Adam and I try to push past last week's dust-up over 300 by devoting this week's top five to friends and friendship.
Plus, Massacre Theater, listener feedback, music from Richard Buckner, and my conversation with the director and stars of the new crime drama, The Lookout.
But we begin with Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle in 2007's first, but probably not last, 9/11-inspired movie, Rain Over Me.
Oh, hey, Charlie! Charlie!
I ran into Charlie Fireman today.
Really? How is he?
Hey, Charlie. It's Alan, man.
We know each other?
Are you kidding me?
Who's Charlie Fireman, Daddy?
He was my college roommate. I haven't talked to him in a long time.
We were college roommates? Yeah, you slept naked most nights. And you were a sleepwalker. It was the worst 2 years of my life.
He lost his whole family in a plane crash. He's lost now.
It's been a week since I saw Rain Over Me, but it wasn't until yesterday morning that I realized why I was interested in seeing the movie in the first place. It's a movie about a guy dealing with grief, in this case, the death of his wife and three young children, without being about dating, sports, or, as my wife astutely pointed out, revenge. Two guys, played by actors I like, Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle, battle sadness with friendship, video games, and rock and roll. I wanted to see this movie because I'm a sucker for movies that are in any way about music, and because I couldn't think of another film that had tackled male friendship in this way. The writer-director of Rain Over Me, Mike Binder, also wrote and directed 2005's The Upside of Anger. Now, I really disliked The Upside of Anger, as you'll recall, Adam.
Of course.
So much so that I'm not sure I actually sat through the entire thing, but I
no,
do remember I do remember enough of it to recognize some similar themes here, namely death, depression, repression, catharsis, and unlikely friendships. Anger, The Upside of Anger, featured Joan Allen's blind rage against the male sex, which I guess was Binder's girl movie. And now we've got Rain Over Me with its classic rock soundtrack and cast full of frigid, controlling, and clinically insane women, and I guess that makes this Binder's boy movie. Now, Adam, I didn't even mention anything about the fact that Adam Sandler's character in the movie loses his family on September 11th, 2001, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that, about Binder's handling of that fact later on. But first, I wanted to ask you if you, like me, found yourself drawn to this film in any way, either because of its subject matter, how dudes grieve, or because of the promise of a Pearl Jam cover of a classic Who track, or maybe something else, and did it work for you?
No, I think that that's pretty accurate. I did want to hear the Pearl Jam cover of the Who song, and like you, I was drawn to the concept from the trailer of these guys and seeing this male bonding friendship, and I also was interested in seeing Adam Sandler in a serious role. I'm still one of those people who is very curious about him after seeing him in Punch Drunk Love, where I thought he was very good, of course, and I know you did as well. I wanted to see what he could do here in a very serious role. So yeah, I was definitely drawn to the movie, and I will say I did make it through all of The Upside of Anger,
right.
And this is a much better film than Upside, though I think it does have a lot of the same flaws, which I'm sure we'll get into here throughout the review. And it's interesting you bring up this idea of 9/11, and it's absolutely true that this movie didn't really need to be about 9/11 in any way. The grief that Adam Sandler's character, Charlie Fineman, is going through after the loss of his family, he could have lost his family in any way imaginable.
Oh,
it doesn't
yeah.
have to be this 9/11 situation. And I can't frankly decide whether or not the fact that it doesn't need to be about 9/11 is actually a good thing because it's a universal type of grief and it just happens to be the scenario Binder chose, or if it's actually a negative because it does end up exploiting 9/11.
Sure.
I'm not sure.
I'm not either.
You know, Binder does try to make it relevant. He tries to use 9/11 as a way to make it relevant to modern day New York. We get some scenes later where, you know, we see him watching the TV and we hear about the war in Iraq, mm-hmm. and this whole concept of fear and being afraid of the people on the street does factor into this movie in some way. But again, I'm not sure where I come out exactly on that idea. But in terms of the film as a whole, despite having a lot of problems with it, as I said, I'll mention, but my big fear about this film was I thought it was going to be The Fisher King all over again. And my problem with that is, A, I already liked The Fisher King. I already saw it once. I liked it when Terry Gilliam did it. And I didn't really want to see Adam Sandler playing the Robin Williams role there. And so I didn't want to see The Fisher King again. And I was also nervous that it would blatantly exploit the 9/11
yeah.
tragedy, because you would have a film that was about a bored dentist, someone who's unsatisfied with his life but basically has everything. That's Don Cheadle's Alan Johnson character. That it would be about the redemption of this bored dentist through the interaction, the intervention of this crazy 9/11 victim. And I was very afraid of that. And I think that the movie, I think Bender manages to not go too far into that area. Actually, Adam Sandler, Charlie Feynman, becomes the main character of this film at some point. Bender wisely makes him the focal point. I don't think he exploits 9/11. I think he creates an interesting relationship where, yes, it is about Alan Johnson and his ultimate redemption in a way, but it is much more about Charlie Feynman's redemption. And with that in mind, I did like the film.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of with you if I'm getting where you're coming from here. I was very, very aware of the flaws of this movie, particularly the writing. I think I sensed the struggle of the writing. I could sort of imagine what the writing process was like. I feel like there are like stretch marks all the way through the movie of like where mm-hmm. this movie was kind of went through drafts. I really did feel like if Mike Binder was a friend of mine and this wasn't a movie starring Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle, but was instead like a play in some storefront theater in Chicago or something, mm-hmm. and I've been there before, I really feel like I'd be able to go up to Mike Binder afterwards and say, good job, man. You know, that's what it yeah. feels like. I felt like it really did satisfy my curiosity in terms of dealing with male grief in a way I don't think many films do that aren't, again, like I said, about sports in some way or aren't outright comedies or, you know, in this movie, it's like rock music is the substitute for sports in some way, or mm-hmm. video games are certainly. And I do think he satisfied that. He was very honest. I appreciate Mike Binder's interest in sort of capturing the honesty with how people interact with each other. I do feel like the writing strikes me as somebody who is just kind of learning to write for film structurally. I'm not an expert on screenwriting, but there seem to be so many situations where he wrote himself into problems that didn't need to be there. Yes. And I think the 9/11 thing is one of them. I think it's just a sort of an oversight on his part. I don't think he's trying to exploit 9/11 with this character. You know, I don't think he's trying to take advantage of that fact. I see this as maybe the first movie ever made that was clearly inspired by listening to an iPod. The first scene that we see is, and it's a beautiful series of scenes. We see Adam Sandler's character on this motorized scooter, and he's going through these empty streets of New York. And I could picture Mike Binder. I'm not sure he was on a scooter. Maybe he was in a taxi cab. He's got his iPod on. A Graham Nash tune is playing, a kind of melancholy mm-hmm. song. He's driving down Fifth Avenue or whatever, and he used to be able to see the Twin Towers. And it's this melancholy music. All of a sudden, you know, this music is scoring his experience in New York City. I've been there. We've all been there to some degree. Yeah. And I think that's the experience Mike Binder had. And he had this moment. He's like, okay. And he got his character, you know, somebody that lost a whole family on 9/11. And the other thing I noticed is the scene that the movie leads up to, the scene that depicts Adam Sandler describing how he lost his family, the thing he's mm-hmm. been repressing for 4 years. Beautiful scene. Beautiful scene. Really well written.
Yes.
Adam well Sandler shot, is too. Incredible. Well shot. It doesn't – we almost never break from Adam Sandler's face.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Sandler is outstanding. I think in the movie, and particularly these scenes when he really has to be good, we talked about the moments that count. I think we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. The moments that count, Adam Sandler is off the charts good.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that scene, I think of that scene as, if I could put money down on it, that's the first bit that Mike Binder wrote. He wrote that monologue, that story first. And then he built a whole movie around it that tried mm-hmm. to justify getting to that point, and it kind of semi-succeeds, I'd say.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, actually. I am very mixed on this film, though I am saying I did like it on the whole, but my problems with it are very similar to the problems that you mentioned. And, of course, you talk about the beginning of this film, this very peaceful, this stroll with the music and Charlie Feynman on his scooter. And then, of course, you juxtapose that with the first time you meet Alan Johnson, who, of course, this dentist character, this stuffy kind of dentist who is sitting in a traffic jam. So you've got the juxtaposition of motion with Alan Johnson's life, which seems stuck in some way. But I think Binder's problem with writing characters is that I noticed this early on in the film, and certainly it's true with The Upside of Anger, is that I think he writes characters and not people. You've got Don Cheadle in this case as this emasculated, unhappy husband, and he's a dentist to boot, which seems to me just very obvious. I mean, when you're trying to pick a character who might be bored with his life, I think dentists probably get picked on a little too often.
Right.
You've got the sassy receptionist, the evil co-workers who are always consorting together like they're some sort of witch's coven out of Rosemary's Baby, the nagging wife played by Jada Pinkett Smith. Everybody seems to have some kind of quirk or neurotic tic that's supposed to make them interesting, but really just makes them feel to me like a construction. And sometimes he tries to be so clever in a lot of his scenes that he pushes the joke way too far sometimes with these uncomfortable moments that just don't work. They make you more uncomfortable when you realize that Bender is actually going for a joke there. And I'll tell you as well where the film started to really go off the tracks for me. And fortunately for the film, it's near the end. It has its North Country moment. It has a big courtroom scene, and you talk about Bender writing problems for himself that he can't really get out of. This movie all of a sudden starts to raise all these questions about Charlie's character that the movie doesn't care about, that we don't care about is he really a threat to society? Is he really better being locked up? These are things we don't really need to get into, and I'm seriously considering going to law school, Sam, just so I can consult with Hollywood movies about how to stage a proper courtroom scene, because this courtroom scene is so emotionally manipulative and unrealistic, it's just absolutely shameful. And that's really where, for me, the wheels started to come off.
Yeah, I agree. I certainly agree with that scene. I think what Bender, and again, everything that he does wrong, I feel like he did in the spirit of trying to make a good movie. And that's why I find it really difficult to fault. And it's strange. I think it might be the first film we've reviewed where I can only barely recommend it to the point where I almost don't want to recommend it, but I'm really glad I saw it.
Yeah,
there's so much really that's good in here, but as a movie alone, just to sort of blindly recommend it, I can't do that. You know, I have to recommend it with several reservations. But I think a case, you know, you're talking about the end of the film, and for me, it is the scene at the end, the courtroom scene that is awkwardly written. But to Bender's credit, what I think he does understand and want to get across is that he understands that he doesn't want to simplify Adam Sandler's grief or the solution to it. He knows that there needs to be a lot of time that passes, and even when he does sort of come out of his shell, he doesn't want that to be too simple. He understands these things, but his execution of that, really, in terms of like giving us a lot of time to spend with Charlie Fineman, so he earns and we earn his catharsis, all he can do really is put one redundant scene after another where Charlie Fineman doesn't quite, you know, reach catharsis.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think we have to end this discussion, Sam, by talking about Adam Sandler's performance. You mentioned how much you liked him in those scenes that count. And I want to mention again, I just want to reiterate what you said, because that really is the best moment in the film, not only because Sandler pulls it off, but as I mentioned, because of the way it is shot. It was either shot with multiple cameras or he at least shot Sandler in one take, because it shows you Sandler get to every moment along the way in telling the story. The camera only occasionally cuts from him and is almost an unbroken take, because we only get a few reaction shots, but it never changes going in for close-ups or anything like that. And so it really builds rather than just punctuating the emotional parts, and in that way isn't manipulative at all. You really see the trip he takes essentially in real time. It's a really smart, really subtle decision. Great filmmaking there and great acting, and I think great writing in that scene as well. But Sandler on the whole, for me, you know, I think he is a character who, like in Punch Drunk Love, he is a guy who, when he plays serious roles, turns into the Adam Sandler guy who just mutters a lot kind of under his breath.
I'm glad you came in, even though you were mad at me.
Yeah, I am too.
Can I say something, Charlie?
Yeah.
It might make you mad again.
No. Go.
That's the way he does serious. The difference is that compared to Punch Drunk Love, where those moments were punctuated, interrupted by his violent rage, here you really do get a sense of true grief, true pain. There is an entire story to Sandler's character that really is in just looking at Adam Sandler and seeing that level of grief. I think he really pulls that off.
I do too. I mean, really, and I don't know if it was makeup or not, but it looks honestly like there's a channel where tears have carved into his face. And I really feel like, I don't think it's makeup. It really is Sandler's kind of manifestation of this character. I really believed it in every moment. And I really think that Bender, in general, with all his actors, really, maybe as an actor himself, gives his actors the freedom to really gives them moments.
Yeah.
Is patient with the camera, lets the camera stick around and hold, and really, you know, lets the characters sort of behave in the scenes. And I think that pays off. Ultimately, another reason why I feel like I can recommend it, in addition to the fact that, you know, he's got the right spirit in making this movie. And I totally agree with your point in terms of painting people as characters. And then he tries to give them more than that. I think particularly the Saffron Burroughs character, which I know we don't have time to get into.
Oh, man.
Terribly misjudged in terms of the character. But he does try to solve the problem he's given himself. He doesn't entirely do it. He puts a Band-Aid over like a gaping wound. But that's, I think, common in this film in terms of how he solves his problems. But I do feel like this is somebody that is really interested in making good films, and I think he will. We'll see him improve. He improved over 2005's The Upside of Anger. I hope to see him improve here, too.
Me too. And fair to say, in closing, that without Don Cheadle, we may have enjoyed the movie even less than we did.
Totally agree. He's great, too. All right. Well, if you've seen Rain Over Me and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, my interview with writer-director Scott Frank and two of his stars from The Lookout, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Matthew Good. Stay with us.
Gary.
Hmm?
Like, I can't do this. I'm just not gonna do it.
Tell you what, why don't you go home, relax, and I'll just send you a check. Now go in there, do your job, and shut your mouth.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Hallgren. That was Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Matthew Good in a scene from The Lookout, a new bank heist crime drama from writer-director Scott Frank.
Scott Frank, of course, responsible for writing two of our favorite movies, Sam, Out of Sight and Get Shorty. He's making his directing debut here with Gordon-Levitt playing a former star athlete in high school named Chris Pratt, whose godlike existence is shattered following a tragic car accident that leaves him struggling with the effects of a severe head injury. I sat down with Frank, Gordon-Levitt, and Good recently and started by asking Frank to discuss the long process of bringing his script to the screen.
It was probably 95, I think, when I first pitched this movie. So it was a long time ago. And I didn't write it right away. I wrote Out of Sight first. I sold this as a pitch to Amblin, which then became DreamWorks. And before I could start writing, Out of Sight presented itself. And there was an option on the book, and they couldn't wait. And so I really wanted to do that. And so I jumped on that and did that. And it just took a long time. The script took a couple years to write, and then there were various directors that came in and out during the process. And by the time the second director had left a couple years ago, I really was at a point where I wanted to direct it myself.
One of the things I really liked about the movie, I really respect, is how straight you play it. I think that there's an expectation with crime movies, this genre in general, but especially these days, to have some kind of big surprise or some kind of twist reveal at the end. Was that a conscious effort on your part not to do that?
I just think I'm less interested in those kinds of stories. I don't know that I was avoiding anything so much as this was just the story I really wanted to tell and the way I wanted to tell it. I like those movies when they have a really satisfying twist at the end. This one just didn't seem to be about that. It felt like oftentimes those movies are about the structure, you know, and about that. And this movie is more about character for me than it is about some kind of tricky narrative.
There's a great scene in the bar where Matthew's character delivers a pickup line perfectly and it works, and then later we see Joe's character try the same line and it doesn't work. Of course, it's not the line is fine, it's all about the delivery. And really this film as a whole is about the power of narrative in some way and storytelling, isn't it?
Absolutely, that is what it's about. And the metaphor for organizing yourself the same way you organize the story, you know, the story of yourself, you know, as a beginning and a middle and an end. And I was always thinking about that and how we could use that in the film and bring it back.
Joe Brick was one of my favorite movies of last year, and that character you play in that movie is kind of a more traditional noir-type character where he's kind of the detective who's always one step ahead of the audience, and here you're playing exactly the opposite. You're playing a guy who we as an audience are always kind of one step ahead of, and you're trying to put the pieces together. What drew you to this role?
Pretty much the same thing as what draws me to any role, which is a good script. They're rare to come by. It seems that good writing has been devalued in the place of special effects and gimmicks and things. But when I read The Lookout, I was pretty immediately up and pacing around and saying the words aloud and inspired, because what I saw was a whole human being on the page and not just a simplistic plot device, and it's exciting. And then when I met Scott, I could tell that he really loved what he was doing. He was doing it for the passion and because he cared about it, as opposed to because it was his job or because it was good money. Once those two things are there, I'm in. That's what I want to be a part of.
One of the things I really liked about your performance is I think it would have been very easy for you to chew a lot of scenery and also develop a lot of sympathy for your character by really playing him as a truly handicapped individual, as opposed to what you did do, which is play him as just kind of a normal guy struggling every day. Was that kind of your approach to it?
Hanging out with people that had suffered similar things to what the character had, I realized that I was pretty much just hanging out with people like I'd hang out with anybody, and there would be isolated moments where I'd remember that, oh, you've been through something I haven't been through. Your brain might work a little differently than mine does. But it's something I've found in developing various characters, that once I hang out with people that might exhibit the same character trait, that these lines that we often draw between us and them kind of fade away, and it just becomes an individual like anybody else.
I think another strength of the performance, too, is that there's some nice ambiguity to it where I wasn't really sure ever what you regretted more, the fact that you weren't Chris Pratt anymore, or the way when people bring up who you were, the way you used to behave. And so what do you think he regrets more? Because certainly there are some memories that are things that we kind of see that moment in you where you go, oh yeah, I used to be like that.
I think he regrets much more that he's not who he was. I think that it's actually in the course of this story that maybe he begins to realize that he wasn't as perfect a person in his past as perhaps he thought he was.
My friend would like to buy you a drink.
Gary Spargo? We know each other. I was in your sister's class.
I heard what happened to you. And everyone was talking about how you woke up this other guy.
Were you with a lady tonight?
That's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, is when Lovely starts telling him the story about the hockey game. And at first he's just delighted to be hearing about his glorious past. And then she complicates it a little bit and points out a few things that he did that maybe were, you know, slightly dick moves. And he'd probably never thought of that before. And, yeah, I like that.
Well, Matthew, coming off Match Point, I mean, if I hadn't known that you were in this film and looked at the press notes ahead of time, I don't think I would have recognized you as the same guy from Match Point. You really are unrecognizable here. What drew you to the character of Gary Spargo, who I guess is kind of the villain in a way in this film?
What drew me? I mean, to be honest with you, I've been looking to try and play a character that's as far away from anything I'd ever done before. And it's quite a depressing thing, looking through scripts, hoping to come upon that. And it was a sort of happy accident in a way. And I picked up the script and I read it and I loved it immediately because, Joe, as you were saying, that it's character-based and it's three-dimensional. And I don't really know what happens, but you read it and you just, something lights up inside you and you're like, oh my God, this is the one. I love it. And obviously I knew it was going to be a really hard job to get, because characters like that and jobs and scripts like this are few and far between. And I was expecting, you know, as one would, that, you know, that a Gyllenhaal or someone else would be queuing up. And so, yeah, just the fact that it was a great story and a great character and something that I hoped would be a really good challenge, because I'm sort of in a phase where I don't want to do anything that's not going to scare the hell out of me right now. So,
well, on the surface anyway, your character in Match Point, again, I did really like that film. So couldn't be more different on the surface, kind of this prim, you know, proper character. But in this film, this guy is very similar in that they're both kind of duplicitous characters, and they rely on their charm to some extent. It's a different kind of charm, but they do rely on their charm and their charisma, don't they?
I think there's a difference between sort of charm, as in English charm, and and charm from anyone else. But you're absolutely right. It's a manipulation of other people via knowing them better than they know themselves, I think, to a certain extent. And that's always something that I find very attractive in a character, where they can, you know, just by the notion of saying something, they can get what they want, which is not necessarily something that happens to me in real life. So, yeah, cathartic.
I'm a big Woody Allen fan, so if you'll indulge me for a second, I have to ask that question about working with Woody Allen, because you hear all sorts of different stories. Some actors say it's the best experience ever, and others say, you know, he barely spoke to me the whole time I was on the set. What was your experience like?
Getting the job was sort of slightly odd. I mean, I basically went into a room and I met him, and I was in there for about 1.3 minutes. And he was like, I just wanted to see what you look like in the flesh, and now I have. So thanks very much. And you're like, oh, God, I didn't get the job. And he works in a way that I really like. I mean, he just lets you make things up and improvise, and as long as the scene conveys what the script kind of originally did, although he loves accidents and happy accidents, then he's rather thrilled. So he does one or two takes, and then he moves on, and I really, really enjoy that way of working, where it's that you do your homework, you turn up, you do it, and then you go home, and it's all sort of quite simple. And it takes a bit of time, because he doesn't really give you too much. Like 60% of his job is just by casting you, and then he just expects it to happen. So there have been obviously cases where people have been fired, and so after the first sort of 2 weeks, me and Emily Mortimer were like, well, I suppose he can't really fire us now, because they can't afford to go back and reshoot any of this, so I think we're in it. Yay! But yeah, no, he's an amazing man. I thoroughly enjoyed him.
I had to give my partner a sign, and that's good. Now he's going to wait 30 seconds until I'm out of the building, make sure you haven't set off the alarm. If you have, he's going to shoot you, Mr. Gwynn, in between the eyes. Okay? I think that'll do it, Loretta. Thank you. Have a nice day.
You too.
Well, Scott, this is a love fest all the way around, because Out of Sight is one of my favorite films, and Get Shorty's brilliant as well. And The Lookout, like those films, some of the best scenes, I think, are just the dialogue scenes, the exchanges, like we mentioned in the bar scene earlier. And I'm curious how big of an influence Leonard was on your writing, and have you always just sort of had an ear for crime dialogue?
I think that Leonard was a big influence in terms of how he uses dialogue to further the plot so effortlessly. You're getting a lot of exposition and you don't feel like you're getting exposition. And the rhythm of it, I really like. It's so naturalistic. But I think when I wrote Dead Again, I think that for me was where I really started to get an ear for that kind of stuff, for that kind of dialogue. And it was reading Red Harvest and books like that that really started to help me learn about sort of being direct. I think characters in crime stories, for whatever reason, you know, you can't have a passive-aggressive character in a crime story. They just don't work. And so people are really direct, and they really say what they want. And it's really fun to write that kind of dialogue.
I'm curious about your decision to shoot the film digitally. Can you talk about some of the advantages of that and the process there?
Well, I knew I wanted to shoot widescreen, and I really wanted to shoot with anamorphic lenses, but the problem was those lenses require a lot of light. And we were experimenting and testing different formats, and I didn't have a lot of time and I didn't have a lot of money in my budget to take the time to light that way. So we tested the digital process, the Genesis camera. I knew that they were shooting Apocalypto with it, and I knew that Superman had been shot with it. And previous systems, such as the Viper, I didn't love because they look like video. They really look like video. And I know that Michael Mann really wanted that look in Miami Vice and in Collateral. He really wanted to see farther than film could see into the dark. And I wanted beautiful blacks. You know, I wanted really rich color. So we tested the Genesis camera, which had gotten pretty good reviews. And we tested that and anamorphic lenses, and we tested also Super 35, another format, widescreen format. And there we were in the Deluxe lab watching them, and the rep from Deluxe, you know, turns to me and he says, I'm a film guy, and the Genesis looks gorgeous. And he was right. It looked really beautiful. And it enabled us to shoot longer in the day. We could go an hour later when the sun was almost all the way down and it didn't look like dusk at all. And we just had more control and we could go a lot faster. And so it was a great process. And the movie, except for a couple of shots, looks like film. A couple of shots people have noticed. But for the most part, it really looks like it's a beautiful look. And I think the whole high-def thing is still in beta, but I think very soon everything is going to be shot that way.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio. We're talking about the new film, The Lookout, with writer-director Scott Frank and two of his stars, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Matthew Good. And Scott, I wanted to ask you, as a first-time director, you've obviously been involved with a lot of projects, but as a first-time director, how closely did the final product end up matching your expectations? And how did the experience of being a director match your expectations?
The experience far exceeded any expectations I had. It was a really great experience, and it was completely satisfying on every level. I mean, making the movie, the process of being on location and making this movie all the way through post-production was a great experience for me, and I really loved it. And I was looking for a new sort of challenge, and it really answered that in a big way. The finished product is never what you think it's going to be. It just isn't. It can't be. And so you have to get reacquainted with the finished product. And, you know, you're constantly evaluating your relationship to the final movie. And all I see is what I did wrong. All I see is where I didn't get it. But I'm really proud of this movie. I really feel very close to it. And I feel like it's maybe the best experience I've ever had in the 20-some years I've been doing this.
That was writer-director Scott Frank with actors Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Matthew Good. The Lookout opens wide next Friday, March 30th.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, a very special edition of Massacre Theater, and it's pretty sad when the History Channel can produce more excitement and adrenaline in a two-hour documentary than this movie can muster. And for that, Sam Van Halgren, you are on notice. Your feedback on last week's bloody battle of 300. Stay with us.
It's almost true. You don't expect to follow, watching what you do. I talked my way, half the night in overdrive, with nowhere else to stay.
Those men who bled the ground red at Falkirk, they fought for William Wallace, and he fights for something that I've never had. And I took it from him when I betrayed him, and I saw it in his face on the battlefield. And it's tearing me apart.
Well, all men betray. All lose heart.
I don't want to lose heart!
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I destroy a beloved screenplay and you get a shot at a free DVD. Last week, we double massacred the scene you just heard from Mel Gibson's Braveheart, a tie-in with last week's top five battle scenes. And I say double massacred because we made things a little more difficult than usual by running the scene through Google Translator from English into Japanese and then back again with nearly impenetrable results. Though remarkably, Adam, many of our listeners got it anyway.
That's true. I was surprised.
I mean, there was a big fat clue in there.
That's so true. Falkirk, I think, was a big hint for most people. Some people are familiar with their Scotland geography, apparently. So.
Right. All right. Well, Adam, reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Justin J. Valentini from Miami. Congratulations, Justin. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Betty.
Yeah, Betty. Look, you don't rush it. I don't rush it. Okay? Now, we're going to play this nice and close, just like in the movies, okay?
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and just when you thought we couldn't top last week's scene, we have a very special edition of Massacre Theater here, where I was able to wrangle Sam,
yes,
both Scott Frank and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, into doing a scene with me here for Massacre Theater.
Major coup.
It ties in with our interview, The Lookout. So think about The Lookout. Think about crime movies.
Right.
That's all you really need to know. And this scene, again, I'm going to give you a hint right now. It is three men, even though when you hear one of the performances, you may be a little surprised to know that. But it is three men in the scene. Let's go ahead and hear my scene with Scott Frank and Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Our problem is take the bank or split right now. Do not go home. Do not pack. Nothing. 30 seconds flat from now, we are gone on our separate ways. That's it.
The bank is worth the risk. I need it, brother. We should stay and take it down. That's where I come out.
I roll with you. Whatever. Whatever.
No, not on this one. On this one, you're on your own.
You figure this is the best thing to do? This is the best thing to do?
I've got plans. I'm going away after, so for me, the reward is maybe worth the stretch. But Elaine takes good care of you. You got plenty put away. You got T-bonds, real estate. If I were you, I would be smart and cut loose of this.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice.
I'm in.
All right, there it is. And how jealous are you, Sam? I can now say that I've worked with Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I've also never been made to look so bad. Not since we did something with D.B. Sweeney, anyway, a couple months
ago. That's true. All right. Well, if you know what film Scott Frank, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and I just massacred, send an email by Tuesday, March 28th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Sam, I applaud you on your review of 300. And Adam, buddy, you totally missed the point of the movie. To me, I thought it was one of the most visceral, entertaining movies I think I've seen in the past, gosh, 3 or 4 years. And I think this movie actually establishes Zack Snyder as a force to be reckoned with in an upcoming movie. So I'm excited to see the stuff that he's going to create.
A voicemail there from Sean in Temecula, who applauds Sam. He says, Sam, that I totally missed the point of 300, and he certainly
didn't
isn't
tell
alone.
You why.
But he didn't tell me why I really missed the point. He just said that he thought it was very entertaining, and I obviously felt that it wasn't entertaining, or at least mildly so. But we definitely have some interesting responses here. One of those films, as we suspected, since so many people saw it, if you look at the box office results, one of the most inspired, passionate mailbags we've had, at least in terms of number of responses. So let's go ahead and jump in. I know we've got someone here off the top, Sam, defending you.
That's right. It's Rick Maragi in Los Angeles. He writes, first, I want to say I found Adam's review of 300 to be a nearly perfect articulation of my problems with the movie if he had been talking about Sin City. Like Sam, I loved nearly everything about 300. Adam, it was Sin City that was guilty of being too slavish to the original text by trying to literally translate page to screen. Every frame in that movie was flat with no depth, and the characterizations were broad and underdeveloped. With Sin City, Rodriguez's conceit was shaky from the start. As he stated, he set out to film a graphic novel, but movies and comic books are different mediums in ways that are too numerous to describe. One cannot simply transfer images and dialogue from paper to film. How could he fail to grasp this? But with 300, I floated out of the theater quoting Leonidas and his soldiers to the point that my girlfriend was maybe 10 minutes away from either leaving me or buying me a muzzle. I felt like a kid again. Zack Snyder stayed faithful to the spirit of the 300 graphic novel, but at the same time created something wholly new and original, something you could only experience in a movie theater filled with the pleasures that great movies provide. That's Rick Maragi writing from Los Angeles. Thankfully, somebody speaking even more articulately and passionately than I could about 300.
Yeah, and that's real tough to pull off, isn't it, Sam? Well, you know what? Rick is a friend of the show. I think we can consider him a friend by now. I think he's listened
absolutely.
To every episode. He writes in regularly with great feedback. But the bottom line is, although I'm so glad he had that experience with the film, he is simply wrong in his characterization of the way this film looks compared to Sin City. And I can prove it. The bottom line is, the proof is in the visuals. Go to our website, filmspotting.net, or go anywhere on the internet and find a clip from the movie 300. I put the Xerxes scene that we played the audio from last week during our review, I put it in the notes for last week's show, Film Spotting number 152, and watch that scene and then compare it to Sin City. I threw in Sin City just last night, Sam, nervous, very scared that what I was remembering is so visually impressive maybe wasn't there at all. Maybe actually the visuals were just as flat as what I remember seeing in 300, which frankly to me looked like rear projection at best. It really was that distracting. I threw it in. Sin City is 100 times better to look at than 300. The visuals are not flat at all, and I think it could be a combination of things like the direction and the CGI team is simply better. Maybe it's just the black and white covers things up. Maybe it's because there's more movement in it. I don't know, and the lack of color. But the fact is, Sin City always looked cinematic to me and was full of depth. In 300, watch that Xerxes scene. You can literally tell that a character is just standing in front of CGI. And while some people may think that's great because it looks like a comic book, I don't go to films to look at a comic book on the screen. So I completely disagree. And I think if anybody goes out and compares the two visually, they'll see exactly what I mean.
But I think Rick's point, and I think it's a really good point, and I know it's a point I made when we discussed Sin City a couple years ago, he really did. I think Rodriguez did, absolutely. He's quoted in print as going out to film the graphic novel, and he made a bunch of errors in doing that. And really, I mean, he brought, Miller was a co-director, and he really just slavishly brought that vision to the screen, and it just completely falls flat. Visually, I never said there's anything wrong visually with Sin City.
I know
in
you
fact,
did.
I I thought it was just fine. And I wouldn't even go as far as some people are with 300 as saying it's so visually astounding. I like the way the battle scenes are executed, but as far as, like, visually astounding, not so great. But my problem with Sin City was really, again, that slavish devotion to a flawed text that doesn't work as a film.
Okay, but that still doesn't have anything to do with the visuals in relation to being slavish to the text. So I think we're talking about different terms here, obviously, but I think if you look at it, really, in terms of what I was saying, it's there in the clips, what bothered me about the flatness to the visuals in 300. So let's go on to someone who agreed with me. And actually, I want to start by reading a couple here, some people who were nice enough to defend me. Arnold Brasino in Colton, California, who said, he can't believe that you, Sam, dislike Sin City, but actually like 300. And he says to me, thank you. You must be the only person that actually agrees with me about this movie in the sense that it loses its momentum. But in my personal opinion, he says the film didn't work for him at all. And maybe there's this sense that I really hated this film as well because we got into such a heated battle about it. The fact is I liked it more than Arnold did. I didn't hate it and was mildly entertained by it for most of the film. Another good one here from Michael who says that he actually wants us to do him a favor where maybe we post the show in stereo, Sam, with me in the left channel, maybe you in the right, so he can actually take the right speaker, unplug it, sell it on eBay for $20, wow, which he'll then donate to the show because he listened to our show and thought that it apparently had to be April Fool's Day, listening to your review and how much you love this film. But the real email here I want to get to, Jeremy Swanston, Falls Church, Virginia, was very excited about seeing this film. I was sure to mark my calendar as the days counted down closer to the opening and wanted to take as many friends as possible because this was going to be the ultimate guy action movie of the year. Give me a beer and a raw steak and let's get down to the action. But as the show faded and the credits rolled, I felt nothing. Just as Adam points out, there was no rush, no excitement as I walked out of the theater like I had with a movie like The Matrix. Despite this lackluster feeling, I was still trying to find something that I liked about the movie. But when I got home and my wife asked how it was, all I could say is utterly disappointed. So I listened to your review and I heard Sam say that he loved 300. I was dumbfounded. Adam, you are absolutely right about everything wrong with this film. In addition, the use of slow motion in this film borders on being laughable, and several listeners agreed with Jeremy's take on that. Instead of heightening the action scenes, it reduces it to an unimpressive sideshow. It appears that director Zack Snyder just discovered this wondrous technique for the first time and decided to use it at every available chance he could. I haven't seen 2004's Dawn of the Dead, but after this, Snyder should be reduced to only directing Kevin Federline videos.
Good Lord, people are catching this hyperbole like it's a virus.
They're jumping on the same bandwagon.
The vanperbole, yes.
Unfortunately, the film was a box office success, and more of his untalented picks are to come. And actually, I think his next picture is The Watchmen, which is also based on either,
yes,
a graphic novel or a famous comic book. So
graphic novel, yeah.
Jeremy is obviously going to be a little more pessimistic walking into that film, but we appreciate the feedback. I especially appreciate Jeremy's response.
Well, let me just respond quickly to the slow motion criticism, which, again, like you said, many people echoed. And I guess part of it for me, why I was so forgiving of the use of slow motion, in that it seemed an antidote to me to all the hyper-editing we're used to seeing, which I find unbelievably boring. Unbelievably boring. The slow motion at least allowed me to follow the action, I think, really well. And because I liked what I was watching in slow motion, I realized what I really liked watching in 300 was watching somebody, a group of men in this case, being really skilled at something. I mean, you talked about, you admitted you really liked seeing that in terms of the way the phalanx worked in that first scene and then ultimately found it redundant. I don't think I ever did, only because I love to see somebody so skilled. And I really think that so did Snyder. And that's what he was really getting a lot of his excitement from, slowing it down, because he really was showing a kind of hyper level of technique in some way. Again, how authentic is their technique? I don't know. I don't care. I just really loved watching it.
I think the problem with slow motion is that it does slow the film down. I feel like a lot of our listeners thought it did bring the momentum down, but I also think it's a cop-out. I think it's a cop-out by a lot of directors and scenes, just as the hyper-editing is a cop-out, in that you don't have to have things brilliantly planned out in terms of your storyboarding, because the fact is you can just slow things down. Things don't have to make sense temporally or spatially because you can shoot an entire battle scene really slowed down. And actually, I think after a while, it did become incredibly redundant for me. So,
for you, yes. Here's one from Josh, who didn't necessarily agree with me, but it's funny, so we're reading it, Adam. He writes, if Napoleon Dynamite was a real person, 300 would have been his favorite movie. I understand Frank Miller's work has an exaggerated pulpy quality, but I would have thought that the way to translate that to film would be to tone it down and bring in gravitas, not force-feed it Mountain Dew and stuff its crotch with rolls of quarters. I can almost imagine the green screen studio littered with empty cans of peck oil, with Zack Snyder giving a single direction over and over. That was good, guys, but could you yell a little louder next time?
This is where we hold them! This is where we fight! This is where they die! And these S.H.I.E.L.D. boys!
I spent the first half hour of the movie feeling like Luke Wilson in Idiocracy. Without depth or characterization, machismo isn't just dumb, it's boring. The funny thing about it, though, was once the battles got going, I sort of started to like it, not because the battles were that spectacular or the story found its stride, but because the movie reached a level of almost sublime idiocy. I mean, why shouldn't Xerxes be an 8-foot-tall, pre-op transvestite with the voice of a Super Friends villain? Why shouldn't the Persians have a mammoth brigade and a saw-armed mutant? Was history really this stupid? In 2,000 years, will movies portray JFK as a jive-talking robot? Who am I kidding? Josh writes, I'd love to see that movie.
I think we'd all like to see that movie, that
wow.
one from Josh Carlin. Definitely a great email. Yeah. And express some of the problems I had with the film. Though it's funny, Sam, that he brings up that idea of whether or not history was really this stupid, and we know he's being tongue-in-cheek
sure.
there. But some people have written in chastising me, telling me that, you know, it's not the history of the Battle of Thermopylae and stuff. And it's like, I know
no
that.
Kidding.
You know, I'm pretty sure that if you listen to the review, the audio will back me up, that I never once criticized the film in terms of its reality or its lack of historical accuracy. I did not go in expecting it to be Saving Private Ryan.
Right. But I do have to say, reading Josh's email, I think I like reading it because it sounds like he's describing a completely different movie. I can just sort of pretend he's describing a different movie. He's using even words I think I would describe a movie I hated as much as he hated 300. I just don't happen to agree that he's right about his depiction of this movie. But I love his level of vitriol.
Yeah, but so many people did write in saying similar things to him, thinking the film really was sublimely idiotic.
Yeah. And I guess the fact is I had fairly low expectations. And the fact that I read, and I think this is important, the fact that I did read the source material, I was prepared for how borderline ridiculous it would be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of like, it's almost like they were parodying a movie like that. I think it's really almost off-putting when you first see it. Just the bombastic nature of the speeches in the film, and I really was surprised more people weren't turned off by it. I was prepared for it, and I recommend people take a look at Frank Miller's original graphic novel and just get yourself into the frame of mind that the movie doesn't even hesitate to launch into right away.
Yeah, though, I don't know if it was Mike or Arnold I read from earlier who made a great point that this movie is the ideal drinking game movie. At some point, they're going to come out with the perfect drinking game for it. So until that time comes,
yeah.
I'm afraid I'm probably not going to partake in this movie again. But we had so much great feedback, Sam. It's really a shame we can't get to more of it. We really were just saying we could build an entire show just around 300 feedback.
That's
it was
true.
That great. And hopefully we will get to some more on a later show. But if you've got any feedback for us about 300 or otherwise, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, or give us a call, 206-203-2463.
When we come back, Adam and I provide 10 examples that contradict Norman Bates' assertion that a boy's best friend is his mother. Stay with us.
Pretty destroyed, coming through, seizure spin around the room. Eastern time, seasons call, they're not the same when they show it all. Are you sitting down? Have you heard around?
Time for a look at what's new on DVD this week, brought to you by PeerFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. Discover, trade, connect at PeerFlix.com.
Well, Sam, definitely the big release I think we would recommend people run out and see if they didn't see it in the theaters. Children of Men, the Alfonso Cuarón film, is out on DVD this Tuesday, along with The Pursuit of Happiness, a film we both liked with a great performance from Will Smith. Also out, Happy Feet, a movie we both missed, right, Sam?
Yes, that's true, but it is on the top of my list. I've promised my wife, not only because she wants to see it, but I want to see it too. Next week,
I
guarantee,
well.
I'm knocking it out,
Curse of the Golden Flower is out, as well as Color Me Kubrick,
a
movie that was actually on my most anticipated of the year list. It's coming out this week in theaters in limited release, and then it's also coming out Tuesday on DVD, so you can check it out. I know we will be interested in seeing that.
All right. Well, we want to thank, too, everyone that went to the filmspotting.net website and donated some money this week to the show. We want to thank Unity Enterprises, a.k.a. 1,000 Pints of Fight, Darby, Thriving in the Spotlight, Andrew, Chalkboard Arrogance, Daniel, Infinite Jocularity, Diane, Seven Fathom Superstition, Anders, Broken Egg Optimist, Nicholas, Eponymous Kettle, Trevor, Institutional Chaos, and Jennifer, Defiantly Bashful. Thanks to everybody again who donated to the show this week.
Hi guys, this is Huxley in Albuquerque. I've been listening to your show since the beginning, and I often play along with your top fives in my head, but this is the first time I've been forced to chime in with my favorite. In your recent top five battle scenes, you accidentally, I'm sure, omitted my number one all-time best battle sequence, the final showdown between the beaten and battered Enterprise, led by Captain Kirk, against the vengeance-driven madman Khan, commanding the hijacked Reliant in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. I must have watched this movie, and this scene in particular, hundreds of times as a kid until the VHS tape literally wore out. I now understand that the amazing feel of the scene was inspired by the great World War II submarine battle movies, and with its tight direction, amazing score by James Horner, and yes, the overacting by Shatner, the sequence still holds up today.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. That was a great voicemail there from Huxley chiming in with one of his favorite battle scenes from Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan. It is a great scene, and it was a great voicemail there. Absolutely a fantastic battle scene, and it was our top five topic for last week, tying in with 300. But we had so much 300 feedback we wanted to get to that we're going to hold off on the battle scenes for a future show. But again, thanks to Huxley and everyone who wrote in. We will get to your emails eventually here. And Sam, if you'll indulge me for 1 second, I want to take a quick moment to just mention a note to say a congratulations to my sister, Melissa, and my brother-in-law, Sean, on the birth of their new baby boy, born on Thursday, March 8th. Blonde hair, blue eyes, 10 fingers, 10 toes, and one incredibly great name, Adam McKinley Hoy.
We wouldn't be talking about this child at all if its name wasn't Adam.
That is probably true, but I am truly honored. They did, in fact, name their son after me.
Amazing.
You too, if you're at home, can do the same thing. Maybe your wife's pregnant.
Feel free.
Adam McKinley Hoy, I am truly honored, and I only hope I can live up to the great responsibility and the honor of it. So congratulations and thanks to both Melissa and Sean for that. One bit of website housekeeping we want to get to. Poll questions. Last week on the show, Sam, we posed the poll question, and many of you went and voted. We asked you, which March movie are you most interested in seeing? And the choices were Blades of Glory, the new comedy with Will Ferrell, The Lookout, Meet the Robinsons, Rain Over Me, Shooter, or 300 again.
Again.
How did it come out?
Well, it came out 25% said 300 again. Yes.
Wow.
Call me up. I will go with you, friends of Film Spotting friends. 25% also said Blades of Glory with Will Ferrell, of course, and John Hader. 21% The Lookout. 19% Rain Over Me. 6% The Shooter with Mark Wahlberg. And 4% Meet the Robinsons. So really sort of a crowded poll there. A lot of interest in various things. Blades of Glory, I have to say, despite the fact that Will Ferrell is in it, I have very little interest. And I know we're discussing it next week, but really, usually, Will Ferrell is enough. I'm there. NASCAR, I'm there.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter. Anchorman, I'm there. I at least had some enthusiasm for that soccer movie he made last year. I didn't see it, but something about this film does not look appealing at all.
Yeah, I know, and I've been thinking about it. Maybe, in fact, it's going to result in us liking the film, Sam, because
maybe
we have such low expectations.
Low expectations, I love it.
So who knows? Maybe we'll be blown away by it. Well, that was last week's poll question. This week's question, you can go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard. We're asking you about Adam Sandler.
Yeah, Adam Sandler. I like Adam Sandler in everything, just in comedies. Depends on the material or when he's not on screen at all. Adam, where do you fall?
Well, I would probably vote for Depends on the Material because I do love him in Punch Drunk Love. And I, of course, as I mentioned, did really like his performance, especially in the serious moments in this film, Rain Over Me, though he doesn't draw me to a film that is bad material, like, for example, the remake of The Longest Yard, which is just terrible. So it really does depend on the film that he's in.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing, too. It really depends on the material, and maybe his co-stars, in this case, Don Cheadle, was a big draw. But yeah, something about Punch Drunk Love and how much I liked that film certainly made this film a lot more appealing. For some reason, though, something like Spanglish, which I know you saw, mm-hmm. which I didn't, that wasn't enough to draw me. So it really does depend on the material, the director, and really what else the movie has to offer.
Okay, well, let us know what you think about Adam Sandler. Vote at filmspotting.net. Which brings us to this week's top five, Sam, movies about friendship, tying in very directly with Rain Over Me. I don't know if we even touched on it, but of course, Alan Johnson, the Don Cheadle character, and Adam Sandler's Charlie Fineman are old college roommates who mm-hmm, reconnect right. and then end up having this male bonding experience and help try to heal each other somewhat. And so we thought it would be interesting to do our top five movies about friendship, about friends. And Sam, I'm wondering if you're going to make our listeners happy for another week by including a Lord of the Rings movie.
Well, God knows I considered it and knew that there would be a lot of expectation out there. So I guess it made my short list, I should say. But I will not be making anybody happy by including it on my list. And when you see my list, you'll be astounded that it didn't make my list. I'll explain a little bit later. Getting into my criterion a little bit, I avoided all movies that were about friendships between men and women. Only because those films usually end up taking a romantic bent. And I guess I have to apologize in advance with how male-centric my choices are. I guess I just – once I got into this list, I really felt like the movies that are really memorable to me, that really are really about friendship in some way, I related to those movies because they're about male friendship in some way. So, again, that's my apology. But you're going to be furious with me, Adam. I took this to the extreme because it started that way. Every single slot here, 5 through 1, I have ties.
Oh, God.
Ties.
We don't have time for this, Sam.
I know we don't. I'm going to quickly get through this, though. Number 5, Anchorman and Clerks 2. These are guys, when you're watching the film, you laugh at. And yet somehow at the same time, you wish you were them. Both films contain that kind of serious moment. And I think every movie on my list, too, is about a friendship being tested in some way. And certainly there is a moment in each of these films where one of the characters is sort of being drawn away from either the group or the other person. And he's confronted. Here, let's play that scene from Anchorman.
I'm a mess without you. I miss you so damn much. I miss being with you. I miss being near you. I miss your laugh. I miss your scent. I miss your musk.
And I, when I don't see you for a while, Adam, I too miss your musk.
That's very true. It is very true. Both great choices, both movies I certainly considered. And it's funny that you pointed out how male-centric your list was. Probably not a shock to most of our listeners. We've kind of been that way with all of our top five lists. We are two guys. It really isn't a shock that those movies probably speak to us more than some female-driven movies do. But I didn't notice until it was too late, actually, Sam, how much my list was starting to overlap with my male bonding top five. We did a male bonding top five back on show number 115. So there is some overlap here, but I did try to differentiate it a little bit, and hopefully my number 5 pick will help me do that. I don't have a Lord of the Rings movie on here, but I do have a Peter Jackson film, and that's 1994's Heavenly Creatures, set in 1950s New Zealand. It's based on a true story about two teenage girls who become close friends, and they create this fantasy world that they escape to, and they eventually become lovers and end up murdering one of the girls' moms in an attempt to avoid being separated. It's Kate Winslet's film debut, and really the movie I think about that it most closely resembles is probably Pan's Labyrinth. It's kind of Pan's Labyrinth before Pan's Labyrinth in terms of creating this imaginary world and really being a visually stunning film that you can imagine from Peter Jackson. They actually even have a name for it. The girls call it Barovnia, and it is a really fascinating film, my number 5.
It's a great pick. All right, well, my number 4, again, another tie, two films about childhood friendships. One, maybe completely unfairly, a film most of our Film Spotting listeners haven't seen, but certainly you have, Adam, and I wonder if you considered it, Son of Rambo, Garth Jennings, which we saw at the Sundance Film Festival this year, and a tie with Neil Jordan's The Butcher Boy, a film I love. These are films about childhood friendships between two polar opposites, really an angel and a devil. And Jordan's film is very much a tragedy. The story of this devil and the devil dominating the friendship, Eamon Owens as Francie Brady, is incredible. And then the Garth Jennings film, very much this comedy, a nostalgic comedy at that, is about the angel and how the angel ultimately dominates the friendship, and really that's how it becomes a comedy. And both films, though, are ultimately really beautiful and moving films.
They are, and you are managing to make your ties stand up here, Sam. I'm proud of you. Let's go ahead and hear my number four, another film, tying in nicely with yours, Sam, that deals with childhood friendships. Let's hear a clip.
As time went on, we saw less and less of Teddy and Vern, until eventually they became just two more faces in the halls. It happens sometimes. Friends come in and out of your life like busboys in a restaurant. I heard that Vern got married out of high school, had four kids, and is now the forklift operator at the Arsenault Lumberyard.
That bit of narration there from Stand By Me, from the end of the film Stand By Me, was one of the first things that popped into my head when we decided to do this top five. I'm pretty sure I played that clip a while back when we did the male bonding top five list. And I think that this movie just really captures that tremendous bond you can have with someone when you're young or just for a fleeting time. And then it's gone. You go your separate ways. And it's something that, again, I just think it really does get right. We've all had that with friendships from our past, and then somehow you end up realizing you haven't seen someone in 10 years, much like the main characters in this film. So with that, Sam, give me some skin. Tell us your number three.
Nice. All right, well, my number three, everybody needs a crazy, fearless friend, somebody who will pack a decoy briefcase with the whites when a woman's life is in your hands, or a friend who calls the midnight to 6 a.m. shift in Vegas. The skank shift, yes, I'm talking about the friendship between Jeff Bridges, the dude, and John Goodman's Walter Subcheck, and Jon Favreau's Mike Peters and Vince Vaughn's Trent Walker in Swingers. And I guess for me, like you and I, Adam, I think are alike in that we're not the crazy friend, you know?
No.
But we have one. In this case, it's my brother. For better or worse, my brother is the Trent Walker of the relationship, and that's why I do have a memory of waking up in a bank drive-thru at 9 o'clock in the morning in golfing clothes, no idea how I got there, Ben asleep in the driver's seat beside me, the teller squawking at us through the intercom. These are the moments that make memories. It's the crazy friends that make memories.
That's true.
And these two films are about those kind of guys.
Well, another nice connection, Sam, with my number three, and I have my first and only tie here. And the first film is With Nail and I. You talk about the crazy friend. Richard E. Grant in this film is the crazy friend, the most self-destructive of the pair, along with Marwood. They play unemployed drunk actors who spend a weekend in the countryside completely unraveling and getting drunk and trying to get drunk. And this is one of those friendships that by the time the film is over, the friendship has to end in order for these people to basically continue living, or else they are both totally going to self-destruct. So it's a completely unhealthy relationship, which a lot of friendships are. And the tie is with Alfonso Cuarón's film, Y Tu Mama Tambien, one of the great endings, I think, in recent memory, where you've got this night of unexpected passion and eroticism, and then a meeting 1 year later at the end of the film. And it's just, again, one of those bonds where you can't imagine these people never being friends. And then you get to the end and you see the reality of it, and it rings so true.
Yeah, no, that's a great pick. Another film that made my short list. All right, my number two, a kind of obvious pairing, and then that they're two Wes Anderson films, Rushmore and Bottle Rocket. And I checked, Adam, to see if Bottle Rocket was in my penalty box, and I don't think it is.
Well, it is now.
I don't know why. It is now. Maybe it is now. But I think what Wes Anderson does is he portrays friendships on screen, and all of his films are in some way or other about friendships. But it's friendships like the ones we had when we were children, or how we remember our friendships when we were children, and it celebrates those without being sentimental at all. And I think it's what appeals maybe to Wes Anderson is that they're friendships at their most pure, and that's what works about them. It's about loyalty. In fact, it's the most important thing in the world in some way. I think certainly of Rushmore, the triptych there. You got Dirk Calloway, Max Fisher, and Herman Bloom. You have these three generations, and there's no division. There's no acknowledgement that there's any age difference really there, and there is a sense of purity in those friendships and the sense of loyalty they all have for each other. And I find those moving, but I also really like his whole take there, Wes Anderson's take on friendship, and how really friendship doesn't change no matter what age you are.
Well, Wes Anderson, you really can't go wrong with any of his films there. A great choice by you. And my number two, look, you're my best friend, so don't take this the wrong way, but in 20 years, if you're living next door to me, coming over watching the Patriots games and still working construction, I'll kill you. And that's not a threat. That's a fact. I'll kill you. That, of course, from Ben Affleck and Matt Damon from the great film Good Will Hunting, minus my Boston accent there. I wanted to spare everyone that. But, you know, that moment in that film is such a harsh revelation for Will, for Matt Damon's character, because he learns that his friends would rather have him gone and be happy and do the right thing than to be hanging around with them. And I think that some of the best scenes in that film are simply the scenes where the guys are hanging out. My favorite scenes in that film are just the guys hanging out, being friends. You've got the great Casey Affleck, Chuck, I want my double burger. Cole Hauser is fantastic. And the way they stand up for each other throughout, you know, I think back to the scene, the double burger scene, where they're going to get out and fight because Will wants to fight and Casey Affleck doesn't want to get out. And Ben Affleck's line is, you're going. And if you're not out there in 2 seconds when I'm done with them, you're next. You know, it's just, we're going to stand up for each other. So Good Will Hunting's my number two.
All right. Well, I reserved my number one slot for two of the most depressing Best Picture winners in the history of film. And really, you reserved the number one slot for the movies about friendship that are also about life and death and alienation, the depressing movies. They are The Deer Hunter and Midnight Cowboy, movies about the kind of friendship born of experience that can kind of exclude everyone else in the world. And these are the kind of friendships where you risk death or humiliation or degradation for a friend, and it's really the only choice to make. And, of course, with these films, neither of those choices ultimately work out all that well. But they do – they are made on behalf of friendship. And really, I might not take a lot of pleasure in either of these two films, but they deserve the number one slot strictly for what they put their characters through in the name of friendship.
Both great picks. I somehow completely forgot about Midnight Cowboy. I'm not sure how, but The Deer Hunter I definitely considered and, in fact, was my number two choice until I realized how much my list was overlapping with my male bonding list. So that was one of the films I left off, along with Swingers and along with another film we love. It was our number one on both of our lists back on the male bonding top five, Rio Bravo, of course,
oh,
Sam.
Sure.
So we left those out, but my number one, let's go ahead and hear a clip.
And when they fly away, the part of you that knows it was a sin to lock them up does rejoice. But still, the place you live in is that much more drab and empty that they're gone. I guess I just miss my friend.
Well, it really is a clip that I think speaks for itself, The Shawshank Redemption, one of your great mistakes, Sam, not properly loving this film. I know you consider it overrated and all because of Tim Robbins' bad acting and one scene in particular on the roof drinking some suds. I don't begrudge you that. It is a bad scene in terms of that smirk on his face, but I think throughout the film he's generally pretty good. I think you should revisit it, and it is absolutely the first movie I thought of when forming my friendships list. In fact, the first words I heard in my head were Red saying, I guess I just miss my friend. So The Shawshank Redemption is my number one.
Well, I'm really glad you put it on there because I was already expecting emails asking us again, where is The Shawshank Redemption? So thanks for taking care of that for me, Adam. All right. Well, that's our top five. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
Opening and wide release this weekend, Rain Over Me, which we reviewed in the first segment of the show, The Hills Have Eyes 2, Mark Wahlberg in Shooter, The Last Mimsy in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and Terrence Howard in the new inspirational sports drama Pride. Next week we'll have reviews of the new Will Ferrell comedy Blades of Glory and the new Korean horror film The Host, which a number of listeners have written in and said we really do need to check out. It's out in limited release. We'll talk about it on next week's show.
We have a lot of people to thank this week. Frank Huckle for his web design help. Dope Sheet editor Jeff Houston. Don't forget, you can sign up for the Dope Sheet, our weekly email blast at filmspotting.net. And to Richard Buckner and Merge Records for this week's music. Learn more at mergerecords.com.
This radio edition of Film Spotting is brought to you by Chicago Public Radio with editorial and production assistance provided by Joe Dassault and Christina Stevens. Distributed through the Public Radio Exchange, Film Spotting is available for broadcast on your local public radio station. More information is available on our website at filmspotting.net. And for Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by the new PeerFlix. Discover, trade, connect at PeerFlix.com.
He wasn't as perfect a person in his past as perhaps
He thought he was. Did you notice that? There were four P's in that alliteration.
That's very nicely done.
Thanks. I just want to do a sweet love story with a beautiful girl. Last few movies I've done, they've had a lot of beautiful girls, but there's always something messed up about it, and you can never just, like, have a nice thing in the movies I've done. So, yeah, that's my fantasy right now.